continue with our study on the English Civil War, and this is part 7. And what we're going to be looking at tonight is the trial of Charles the First. And in order to do that, we want to put it in its context, so we're going to look at how the legal system functioned at the time. What was the expectations? What was a normal situation for being in a court of law? Peterson says that at this time, defendants had no rights other than to be tried quickly. Cases had to conclude within the day, so there was one day. And your right is, we'll do it quickly, so don't worry about it. The defendants were not permitted to give evidence on oath, to cross-examine witnesses, or to have the assistance of counsel. Other than they were able to have counsel, if the court allowed them, only to argue points of law. So not in the sense of the accusation that came or what, so they could get counsel. Well, what does that law mean? How does it apply? Whatever. Those who refused to plead were either returned to prison and pressed to do so. And when they say pressed, they mean pressed. They would put heavy weights on you and basically begin to squash you until you decided to sign or you died. So, you know, those kind of sayings have passed down to us. Oh, you, it feels like you're pressing me here. Comes from our British heritage. Or else, if they refused to plead, they were told that their refusal to plead was taken as a confession of guilt. There was no disclosure of the prosecution case. There were no adjournments, and there was no appeal. So that was kind of cut and dried, it's done. Now, a defendant might ask a judge to put questions to the prosecution witnesses. They could interject and make a final speech, but that was all. The slightest disrespect to judges was severely punished as contempt of court. So that was the legal setting of the time. So if you're above the law, as Charles I and his predecessors believed they were, I mean, why bother yourself with the legal system? You're never even going to come across it. It's got nothing to do with you or your family or your people, so you just leave it in that deplorable state. And so they didn't worry about it. Why care about those who had to go through that system? And maybe there is another reason behind them not caring. We could see that they didn't care, but maybe there was also something self-conscious, because it was a way that you could get rid of your opponents or people standing in your way very quickly. Rushed through the system as the Star Chamber was used. That was the king's court. He had set up his guys. And so that's maybe another reason that they didn't change it. In the light of the legal system that was in place when Charles was brought to trial, Robertson says, the king's judges, these are the judges that were appointed to judge this case against the king, he says they showed unprecedented consideration for the defendant. On the other hand, the king gave no respect to the court. There were 70 prominent people of standing in society that were chosen by Parliament to sit as the judges, and the king gave no respect at all. He was very rude and discourteous to the whole court. The court had determined to tolerate this. They weren't going to get sidetracked with his stuff. I mean, what do? Hold him in contempt, and then what? So, John Bradshaw, he was the president of the High Court, and he was the man when he was asked by Parliament to assume this position, his wife just freaked out because of the fear. and he first turned it down, and Parliament said, we can't accept that, turning it down. We need, and eventually he accepted it. And he had this wide-brimmed hat made that was lined with lead. So to try and, you know, if somebody's going to shoot him, kind of to protect his temples and stuff, just to give him a fraction of security for being assassinated, because you've got this conflict that's there with the royalists and these parliamentarians that are trying to deal with him. And so Bradshaw explained to the king what was taking place and why. So when the king came in, as the court started, Bradshaw explained to him what was going on. And he said, Commons of England assembled in Parliament, being sensible of the evils and the calamities that have been brought upon this nation, and of the innocent blood that has been shed in it, which is fixed upon you as the principal author of it, have resolved to make inquisition for the blood and according to the debt they owe to God. Okay, so he's saying, we have determined as Parliament to make inquisition about this blood that has been shed by you. And the reason we are doing this is because of our debt we owe to God, because of our debt we owe to justice, to the kingdom, and to ourselves. We have this debt, and therefore that's why we are going ahead with this. And therefore we have resolved to bring you to trial and judgment, and have therefore constituted the High Court of Justice. And then John Cook, who was the prosecutor, kind of the main legal guy who is drafting, how do we actually make this legally binding and stickable? He was the Solicitor General for the Commonwealth, and he stood to read the charge brought against the king. As he began to read, he was standing quite close to the king, and the king hit him with his walking stick. And Cook ignored him, and so the king poked him. And Cook continued to ignore the king and continued to read the charge, whereupon the king struck him so hard that he snapped the silver. He had the silver point on the end of his stick. He snapped it off, and it fell to the ground. And the king then motioned to Cook to pick it up, and Cook just refused. He just stared the king in the eyes and went back to reading the charge. He rejected that. And continued reading, saying, I do in the name and on behalf of the people of England exhibit and bring into the court a charge of high treason and other high crimes whereof I do accuse Charles Stuart, King of England, here present. So there's tremendous courage, tremendous conflict going on. And as Cook was reading the full charge, it was longer than what I've read there, but as he kept reading the charge, to the astonishment, there were several thousand people in this huge hall that they had set aside for the trial, but to the astonishment of the people there, the king bent down and picked up this point of his walking stick and put it in his pocket, which was, you know, the symbolism is all very striking, particularly to the people in those days. And as Robertson says, it was the moment for which Cook would never be forgiven, the moment when the king was forced to bend almost prostrate at his prosecutor's feet, while the law, which he was no longer above, took its course. And so you see this transition, and even if people didn't quite realize what was taking place, the symbolism was tremendous, saying, wow, the king is bowing the feet of... And the king, in fact, afterwards was very disturbed about this incident, that thing breaking off. He was, and even one of the newspapers picked it up and said, this is an ominous sign. So I don't know how significant it was, but I mean, in picture form, it certainly was sending a message to the people of the day. When the full charge had been read, Bradshaw then asked the king how he would answer the charge. And the king said, I would know by what power I am called hither. What's the authority of this court? So that's the king's position. That's where he's standing. So he's trying to find out, by what authority can you put me on trial? There was some back and forth between Bradshaw and the king, the essence of which the king kept demanding to be shown the lawful authority for this court. Bradshaw at this stage was kind of floundering a bit and kind of caught off guard, I think. I don't know, it was just, you know, one of those things. The parliament that was meeting, you know, because what the king was accusing was saying, like, okay, parliament called the high court, yeah, but that parliament that met to call the high court didn't have the House of Lords present. And the parliament that met, the king didn't say this, but he could have, maybe, the parliament that met didn't have the Presbyterian MPs in it. And so he's accusing the parliament that met as being this lawless, shoddy gathering. And the king ended by saying, you have shown no lawful authority to satisfy any reasonable man. To which Bradshaw replied, this is your apprehension. This is your opinion. We think it reasonable, and we are your judges. Whether that carried the day or not, I don't think it did at that point, but at least he silenced the king, and then he ordered the guards, take him out. and they removed him from the court. That was a Saturday. And so then there was the rest of the weekend, the rest of Saturday and Sunday, for both sides to work on their cases. And then Monday, the 22nd of January, this is 1649, the trial reconvened, and at which time they received a petition from the Scottish Parliament to abandon the trial against the king. Okay, so the Scots are now asking, stop. The king still refused to plead, demanding that the court prove its legitimacy before law. Cook's position, resting on the accepted common law at the time that had been developed up to that time, was that the court was an act of Parliament, and acts of Parliament couldn't be questioned in a court called by Parliament, because judges in this court were not able to question the political sources of their own power or authority. Okay, so this is the argument from common law, was that Parliament called a court, called these judges. The judges have no right to question. They're only a judge because Parliament appointed them. They cannot question the source of the thing that appointed them. That was his reasoning. There was another vital fact that enhanced the lawfulness of these proceedings. You can weigh it up and decide for yourself where you come down on this, but this is another important point that mustn't be overlooked. And this arose from the unquestioned legality of a victorious army to detain enemy leaders. This was universal law. Nobody questioned it. Nobody argued against it. It was universally practiced. It was universally accepted and uncontested. The army was holding the king captive. That was fact. He was under their jurisdiction. They were keeping him detained. And this is an important point, because with all the top-level counsel that the king had access to, they didn't stop. They allowed the best legal brains in England to have access to the king, and they were building his case and helping him. And all of them combined, including the king, who was a sharp man as well, none of them came up to contest the detention and call it unlawful. And the fact that they didn't question the detention of the military as unlawful, they didn't challenge that, and they didn't bring up, you know, the habeas corpus, where that's a universal law principle as well, where I can challenge you detaining me because you don't have a basis in law to detain me. So that's a place to fight. Not you putting me on trial. You don't even have a basis to hold me in detention. He didn't raise that. They didn't bring it up because they acknowledged the fact that he had been at war with this army. This army had conquered him. They had captured him. They had the right not only to detain him, but to court-martial him and execute him if they found him guilty. And so he never challenged that at all. And maybe there was a strategy that of his. I mean, it didn't ultimately work, but maybe, you know, let me take this route. Because if I go back to that route, they'll say, fine, let's go that route. Maybe. So he never challenged that. And so the king never challenged that legality. And so with not challenging that, basically what you've got is proving that the army had legally detained the king, had legal authority over the king, and the army had now joined with this court, and whatever way, I'm not sure how all you're going to work through all that, but in their minds and their understanding was the army had granted sanction to this court to do the trying for them as opposed from them doing the trying. And so that's kind of the way it was now going. Now, through Wednesday and Thursday, Cook brought witnesses. He brought royalist soldiers who had served with the king in order to prove the fact that they were being commanded and directed by the king, which he was. He was a very active commander on the battlefield and was with them and directing. So he was the one. And so Cook is trying to connect. If you're the commander of this army, then you're accountable for what your army did. And so he was proving that. He was had witnesses as well, placing the king in places where they were beating and torturing prisoners of war, where the king was giving permission and instructions to do that. And they were robbing and stealing stuff from people, which was against the conventions of law. So there was a lot of detail coming out with the witnesses. Also what Cook presented was was some of the correspondence. And so Cook was trying to establish the fact that the king was waging war against Parliament personally and enthusiastically with real effort, and that he bore the command responsibility of the war crimes of the soldiers, and that he was responsible as an individual for ordering and approving the torture and the plundering of towns, Even more damaging were his secret letters full of double dealings and attempts to procure military assistance from Catholic powers from Ireland and from Scotland. That was all in his handwriting. They had documents showing this. So all Cook is pointing out is that you had declared war upon your people. Now the judges, after reading all the king's correspondence and obtaining further assurance from the witnesses that they had heard, that these witnesses were actually telling the truth, and after much deliberation through the whole of Friday, this questioning was Wednesday, Thursday, the whole of Friday the judges were meeting, and then they arrived at their verdict on Friday. On Saturday, the king was brought before the court. The king at this point started, all through this whole week, he had been stalling and wanting to speak, and they gave him chance to speak, but he just kept stalling. And now, once again, because he realized, I'm coming back in, the verdict is going to be read, I want to say one more thing, I want some more time to speak. And Bradshaw said that the king was not above the law. So Bradshaw started speaking, the king was brought in and said, you are not above the law. And pointing out that for the king to pit his single judgment against the law made by the people of England through their elected representatives had been his fundamental error. He was opposing what they determined to be the real authority, and for which courts of justice could therefore call him into account because he had violated this fundamental principle. His office was one of trust, elective in the sense that it required the continuing consent of the people. Tacit so long as Parliament was meeting to redress their grievances. So that was the balance. And that was all they were trying to establish in the beginning. And Charles refused. He could have avoided execution. But he was wanting total power. He wanted absolute control. And they wanted to establish, which now they're reiterating again, but now it's gone past that, was that all we were trying to establish is that you are accountable to the law, whereby the people had avenue for redress through the parliament, and you refused that. Remember, he closed parliament for an extensive period of time. For all Charles's talk at his trial of the liberty of the people, the great bulwark of the liberties of the people is the Parliament of England. So he's kept talking, that's liberty, I was trying to defend liberty in the country. And they say, no, the great defender of liberty is Parliament. And that's the thing you crushed or try to crush. And by subverting and rooting up that which your aim had been to do, you had confounded the liberties and the property of England. Parliament represented the people, and an attack on Parliament was an attack on the people. That's what Robertson was saying in his book. Bradshaw went on to state that the people's allegiance to the king it rested upon him protecting his subjects. He said, look here, the people's allegiance rests on your protection. Should you fail in this agreement, they have every right to throw off your authority. So this bond between allegiance and protection, Bradshaw said, and as he ended off with this particular part, he said, sir, if this bond be once broken, farewell sovereignty. And so that was his evaluation of the full thing. Now, as Robertson says, that this set up the rhetorical question, sir, whether you have been, as by your office you ought to be, a protector of England or a destroyer of England, let all England judge. And I think that was their fundamental goal from the beginning. Let England judge this. Have you fulfilled your responsibility or have you done the opposite? Bradshaw continued saying that the king's arbitrary government was tyranny, his breach of trust was treason, and that all the bloody murders which had been committed must be laid at his charge. For the crime of murder, this is Bradshaw continuing, the common law of England and the law of God laid down the sentence of death and laid it down for everyone, kings not excepted. The king then realized the game was up, and he once again tried to interject, and he appealed to be given a chance to say something before the sentence was actually given, because Bradshaw or somebody else was going to actually read the sentence. Bradshaw told the king that his time was past, and then said, truly, sir, we are not here to make law, but to apply law. We may not acquit the guilty. What sentence the law affirms to a traitor, tyrant, murderer, and public enemy to the country, that sentence you are now to hear and have read unto you, and that this is the sentence of the court. And so he silenced the king there. The official verdict was then read, which ended with, which really was how Cook had opened his charge in the beginning against the king, but the charge being read was, "This court does adjudge that the said Charles, as tyrant, traitor, murderer, and public enemy to the good of the people of the nation, shall be put to death by the severing of his head from his body." As Robertson points out, he said that the king's trial had been conducted with a fairness and a politeness that was unparalleled in criminal proceedings, and which set an important precedent. There was a new standard that was introduced into the nation as to how even people you might despise need to be treated in a court of law. The court, after all, had looked and acted like a court, a much fairer court in public memory than the king's own Star Chamber. And so after the king, I didn't want to go into too much detail there, but he was beheaded publicly, and after he was beheaded, he acted very bravely and gave his last appeal, saying he was innocent and was not guilty of anything. But they then beheaded him. Then John Cook published his case against the king, and Cook claimed that kings were trusted with the power to govern that was limited by a common law that entrenched the people's right to a regular parliament for the redress of their grievances. Charles's coronation oath bound him to preserve the peace and to observe the law. It reflected the political fact that all just power is now derived and conferred by the people who consent and voluntarily submit to a form of government. They may consent to a king and even hereditary kingship, but always retain the right to withdraw that consent, even if the hereditary monarch behaves himself properly. So he's saying now, the king, they can do that if they want a king. They can set up a hereditary king line. But at any point down that rule, we can decide, okay, we're done with that. We want to establish another way of governing ourselves, which I think is enshrined in our declaration and constitution. Cook said, "This law, if the king become a tyrant, he shall die for it. And this law is the law of nature and the law of God, written in the fleshly tablets of men's hearts." So he's saying this is inescapable, what has taken place here. And I want to end off by reading just the last, literally the last section from Calvin's Institutes. The last chapter of his Institutes, he's dealing with civil government. But when you come to the last section, the last words he says in the book, and this is what he says. And he's been talking about obedience. And so now he's qualifying, saying, "But in that obedience, which we have shown to be due the authority of rulers, we are always to make this exception. Indeed, to observe it as primary, that such obedience is never to lead us away from obedience to him, to whose will the desires of all kings ought to be subject." Okay, the desire of all kings ought to be subject to the will of God. "To whose decrees all their commands ought to yield, to whose majesty the king's scepter ought to be submitted. And how absurd would it be that in satisfying men you should incur the displeasure of him for whose sake you obey men themselves. The Lord, therefore, is the King of kings, who when he has opened his sacred mouth must alone be heard, before all and above all men. Next to him, we are subject to those men who are in authority over us, but only in him." That means those in authority have to be in Christ. "If they command anything against him, let it go unesteemed. And here let us not be concerned about all the dignity which the magistrate possesses, for no harm is done to it when it is humbled before the singular and truly supreme power of God." Okay, so this paragraph, well, we haven't finished, but this paragraph, this thus far, appeared in the first edition of the Institutes, 1536. We're talking about 1649, 113 years or whatever after this. And the English are still struggling. The Scots had it, but it seems they were floundering now because of their church polity. That, you know, their lights had kind of faded a bit. Knox had gone, Goodwin had gone, Goodman and John Perrier and some of those had gone. But 113 years later, that it was funny. That I have a book by a man called R.H. Murray, He wrote this in 1925, but the title of the book was The Political Consequences of the Reformation. So he's looking at the thinking and the development of the thinking. And then he says this. He says, the English were slower, because less logical, than the Scots to adopt the teaching of Geneva. I don't make any comment on that. I'm just pointing, that's what Murray thought. But Murray sounds like a Scottish name, so it's probably biased. In the Institutes, that first section appeared in 1536. Calvin, in updating his Institutes, he kept updating it. And the final update in 1559, he added another paragraph that I'll read now. On this consideration, Daniel denies that he had committed any offense against the king when he had not obeyed his impious edict. Daniel 6:22, when the king had said, don't pray, and he had prayed, and then he had been thrown in the lion's den. For the king had exceeded his limits and had not only been a wrongdoer against men, but in lifting up his horns against God, had himself abrogated his power. Conversely, the Israelites are condemned because they were too obedient to the wicked proclamation of the king in Hosea 5:13. For when Jeroboam molded the golden calves, they, to please him, forsook God's temple and turned to new superstitions, 1 Kings 12:30. With the same readiness, their descendants complied with the decrees of their kings. The prophets sharply reproached them for embracing the king's edicts, Hosea 5:11. Far indeed is the pretense of modesty for deserving praise, a false modesty with which the court flatterers cloak themselves and deceive the simple, while they deny that it is lawful for them to refuse anything imposed by their kings. Okay, so they're flattering the king, and then they say there's nothing we can refuse. As if God had made over his right to mortal men, giving them the rule over mankind, or as if earthly power were diminished when it is subjected to its author, in whose presence even the heavenly powers tremble as suppliants. Okay, so Calvin inserted that, and then I've brought it up before, but it's interesting because after the 1559 update to the Institutes, Calvin then went on to write his commentary on Daniel. And when he wrote his commentary on Daniel, he went back to this verse that he had quoted here in this beginning of this update section. And in his commentary, Daniel says that Daniel was compelled to obey the rule of God. He disregarded what the king had commanded to the contrary. For earthly princes abdicate their power when they rise up against God. Worse, they are unworthy to be accounted in the number of men. We ought rather to spit in their faces than obey them when they are so shameless as to want to even despoil God of his right and, as it were, occupy his throne. Okay, that's from the T.H.L. Parker translation of Daniel. Now, you do have that set, which in many cases, the most common set was really redacted to a degree to make it more compatible with the common market. But anyway, that's the T.H.L. Parker translation, which is a good one. And now just the last little bit of the paragraph. So you had this last section in the Institutes divided into three sections. The first section was written in 1536. And then this section we just read was in 1559. And then the last section was from the 1536, the original Institutes. And just thinking of the incredible insight that Calvin had in those days. And so we end off with that last paragraph. And he says, I know with what great and present peril this constancy is menaced, because kings bear defiance with the greatest displeasure, whose wrath is a messenger of death. That's what Solomon says. But since this edict has been proclaimed by the heavenly herald Peter, we must obey God rather than men, Acts 5:29, let us comfort ourselves with the thought that we are rendering that obedience which the Lord requires when we suffer anything rather than turn aside from piety, and that our courage may not grow faint. So that our courage may not grow faint. Paul pricks us with another goad, that we have been redeemed by Christ as our great price as our redemption cost him, so that we should not enslave ourselves to the wicked desires of men, much less be subject to their impiety. Now it's interesting, as he starts off, it's a little bit confusing, that last paragraph. I know with what great and present perils this constancy is menaced. because kings bear defiance with great displeasure. And I'll bring that out a little bit clearer. But first he says, I want to deal with this sentence where he says, let us comfort ourselves with the thought that we are rendering that obedience which the Lord requires when we suffer anything rather than turn aside from piety. And it's interesting, he uses piety there. And piety can tend to turn us into dualistic understanding. Well, what do we mean by piety? Well, we've got the sacred-secular distinction. We've got this thing. And it's interesting. So that was written, the 1559 edition was in Latin. Calvin wrote his Institutes in Latin, and then he made his own translations into French. And the reason he translated into French was because he was wanting these to be read by the common man, the French people. And so he kind of, it wasn't a strict translation, but you still got the man who's communicating his ideas. And so you can go to, I also have the 1541 English translation of the French translation of the Latin made by Calvin. The English translation was done by somebody else. And so you go and you look at that, and it's interesting, that word piety, it helps us understand what was Calvin thinking of. And the French has their holy speech. That's the direct translation. I've also got a French version, and the straight translation, although I don't speak French, but I was using Google, so maybe Google fooled me, but the direct translation of the French there was holy speech, and the English translation of the French that I have is holy word. So God's holy word. Whenever God's holy word is violated, we should rather suffer anything than go along with that. And so this is what Calvin is talking about. And now that beginning of that last paragraph, which is a little bit clumsy in the Latin that's translated into the English, this is what it is in the French. He says, I know well what danger can come from such a constancy as I ask here. I am asking you to act consistently with refusing to bow to anything that doesn't comply with God's words. And I realize what could come from this, what I am asking you. Since kings cannot allow themselves to be brought low or, as the Latin has, because kings bear defiance with the greatest displeasure. And so it kind of gives us an insight into Calvin's mind. And to be fair, Calvin, I don't believe, my understanding of his position was he was reluctant to go to regicide. The king could be executed. Now, Beza, who followed Calvin, he definitely said there's a place for that. And so you see this growth as events transpire in the world, as things happen, you see the growth in the thinking. And then you've got the whole Scottish thing with Knox going back to Scotland and some of the guys who were influenced in Geneva as well, going back and writing and tangling in these things and trying to wrestle through. And we see, as I think Murray was probably right when he said, the English were behind the Scots in thinking through these issues and understanding Calvin and actually applying him. And they were catching up by the time we deal with Charles I. But it wasn't easy. And I don't suggest that this case is easy. You need to wrestle with it. But we have to be thinking about the anomalies. What happens when you don't have the perfect situation? What happens when, how do we act? What does law look like when it's not all neat and cut and dried? How do we do that? Even our own history is one of, well, what do we do when we've got a tyrannical power that's legally, and they're acting, well, now we need to govern ourselves. We need to commit ourselves to our laws. And so my desire is that this just helps you wrestle with these important topics. We're not through the woods yet in our own nation and realizing the incredible relevance of what we are facing and could face.